And we helped them purchase their first buy-to-let with savings that they'd made through their earned income. They bought in London, which I mentioned earlier. You tend to find out historically has been good for capital growth. So when we came to review the mortgage in 2 years' time, there was a bit of equity that we could take out of the property. And so when we came to remortgage, we withdrew some equity through additional borrowing, and the additional funds meant they could set up a limited company. So the first purchase had been in their personal name. They then made a decision to set up a limited company to purchase more properties. And they purchased a couple of properties with the equity that we released. I think that was around the Liverpool area that they went to purchase, which gave them good rental income and so allowed them to start drawing an income from their investment property. And again, we kept reviewing the mortgages every couple of years and drawing out as much as we could to allow them to continue to grow their portfolio. And I think they're now up to 11 properties and that they own in there, and that's over the course of, say, 5 years. And it's given them the freedom to give up the job, so they're no longer working as a solicitor.
The Medics Money podcast helps doctors, dentists and other professionals make better financial decisions. Hosted by myself, Dr. Tommy Perkins, a GP.
And by me, Dr. Ed Cantelow, a GP, but also a chartered accountant and chartered tax advisor.
This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute any form of advice, and tax allowances and rates are subject to change.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Medics Money podcast. Today we're going to be rocketing through a buy-to-let masterclass with our special guest that I'll introduce in a moment. We're going to be covering differences between buy-to-let and conventional mortgages, returns, limited companies, and lots more, so stay tuned. I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast Michael Benison of Benison Brown. Hi Michael.
Hi Matthew, thank you very much.
No, very good. Thanks for coming along. Happy New Year. And for those of you, we just talked about this off air. You've been on with Tommy before, a little while ago now. But for those of you who may not have heard it, do you want to give us a quick little introduction for investors?
Yeah, certainly. So we're Benison Brown. We're a whole of market mortgage brokers able to help either residential or buy-to-let mortgage clients. And we've got a very good reputation for service. So if you find us on Google, we've got a 5-star rating with over 600 reviews between our two offices between London and Bristol.
Fantastic. Great stuff. So what we're going to be talking about today is buy-to-let versus residential, right? So I'm going to kind of fire off some questions. Hopefully it won't be too much. I mean, first off, like, can we just go through how does a buy-to-let compare to a standard residential? Because most people will be familiar with a residential or standard mortgage, but maybe not a buy-to-let.
Yeah, certainly. So buy-to-let mortgage is a mortgage specifically for letting out properties rather than obviously somewhere for you to live like a residential mortgage. It's calculated differently in terms of the amount that can be borrowed. So the amount that you can typically borrow on a buy-to-let will be predominantly linked to the rental income of the property, and rather than a residential mortgage, which is going to be more based on your earned income that you receive. So the key differences, I guess, are around the use of the property, so specifically for letting out property rather than your residential mortgage, and also the amount of borrowing is based purely on the rental income rather than earned income.
And so it's sort of a investment. Can we think about it like that?
Yeah, an investment mortgage could be.
Brilliant. Yeah, so why, I mean, there's so many different types of investment vehicles and, you know, options out there. Why would someone maybe consider investing in a buy-to-let property or property more generally?
So reason to consider investing in property, I think it's always good to diversify your portfolio. So if you've got shares, if you've got savings, having some assets within properties is a good thing to do. I think diversifying it and obviously taking advantage of different market growth. In particular, buy-to-lets, you're probably normally looking at one of two things. So either you're looking for capital appreciation, so you're looking to invest in the property and then at some point in the future sell it and appreciate the capital that's grown. Or the other thing is that you can also gain additional income from it as well. So the rental income can obviously be taken as profit and used as you see fit. And so depending on your goal, determining whether you want to look at the capital appreciation or whether you're looking more to drive the rental income, could determine what type of property you buy and also where you buy, because different areas of the country and different properties can help you achieve different goals.
I suppose because there's so many different types out there, it kind of makes it difficult to give an idea of what return one might expect when investing in these things. But is there general ways that investors could maybe look at calculating how much they expect to return?
Yeah, so to calculate the return on interest, or the rental yield, as it's called in the buy-to-let world, it's the ratio of the annual return income against the property's value expressed as a percentage. So in other words, it shows how much income you can generate relative to the cost of your investment. So for example, a £100,000 purchase with, let's say, £8,000 annual rental income would be an 8% return on your investment. And then for buy-to-lets, you're typically looking at a return of somewhere between 5 to 8%. It's generally considered a good yield. And as I said earlier, depending where you buy in the country determines how close you can get to those returns.
Absolutely. And what should someone consider when looking at properties? What sort of factors do we need to be mindful of when deciding about buy-to-lets?
So depending on the long-term goal and whether you're looking for the capital growth or looking to maximise your yield, determines what and where you might buy. So considering what your goal is, I guess, is one of the first key points, and that can help narrow down your search. And there's some basics that you need to do in terms of research. So researching the local market, understanding how much rental income it's going to generate and what the demand is in that area, how easy it is it's going to rent for. And also any potential costs that you might have to consider for repairs to the property, considering the purchase costs of the property, probably getting a good surveyor in to make sure that you know what things might cost in the future. Thinking about whether you want to be a hands-on landlord. So do you want to be involved? Do you want to find your own tenant, or do you want to give it to an agent to let out for you? If you do want to be hands-on, then making sure it's commutable from home is probably a good idea. Considering what type of tenancy agreement you want to have in place. So are you looking to let this out on a long-term rental and then forget about it? Or do you want to try and maximise your rental income? So maybe considering a HMO property and house of multiple occupation property, which would probably give you a higher rental yield. Or maybe you want to have something that you could use yourself. So maybe you're looking at, say, a holiday let, for example, by the coast, and that you can let out for the majority of the year, but also use it for you and your family for certain holiday times as well. And so thinking about what your goals are and what you're looking to achieve are kind of the key points. And then, as I say, the basics around research in the market, making sure you know what that rental income will be and how easy it will be to achieve.
Fantastic. Okay. So in terms of specific eligibility requirements, so how is there anything people need to be aware of, anything they need to kind of, any criteria they need to meet before they get approved or before they try and think about getting a buy-to-let mortgage?
Each lender's got their own criteria. There's some, I guess, some basics that most lenders adhere to, but again, we can normally find a solution for most clients. Typically, a lender wants you to be an owner-occupier already, and so they already want you to have a property at least, ideally somewhere that you live in yourself. And they normally want you to be able to evidence an earned income as well. And so they want maybe an income of, say, around £20,000 away from rental properties. However, as I say, there are high street lenders that don't have those criteria, so there's normally a solution for most people. In terms of, I've mentioned earlier, calculating what can be borrowed, it's going to be based normally on the rental income. And what they tend to do is a stress mortgage rate, which is somewhere between 5 to 7%, let's say. And then they'd want the mortgage to cover either 125 or 145% of that figure, depending if you're a higher rate taxpayer or not, or if you're using a limited company, which we'll talk about. And so as an example, for every £100,000, as a lower rate taxpayer or limited company, you'd need around about £520 to £620 monthly rental income to come in. And then if you're a higher rate taxpayer, that probably goes to about £620 and £720 rental income that they'd need to be able to service the mortgage.
Is that what the lenders look at and they assess, or is that what you need to actually kind of pay it off, if that makes sense?
That's what the lenders look at to assess. And your mortgage payments are probably going to be a little bit lower than that, so there'll be a profit. But the lenders are looking at what happens if something goes wrong, obviously making sure that you've got money to pay your tax bill at the end of the year, and then still be able to afford the mortgage. So they're doing your kind of worst case scenario for you. And they'll send a surveyor to go out and make sure when they value the property, they'll check the value of the property as they always would. But on a buy to let, they'll also check what the rental income is going to be to make sure that they feel the mortgage is affordable for you.
Yeah, of course. I'm just going to check my understanding at this point. So from what I've understood, it's essential or highly preferred to have a foot in the game already with kind of in the property market and maybe already rental income coming in. Is that correct?
Yeah. So ideally, you'd either have your own property that you live in. So you could be a first-time buy-to-let landlord, but you already own somewhere. Or you could have maybe already invested in properties in the past and can evidence that. Essentially, what the lender's really wanting to make sure is what you're not doing what they call a backdoor residential. So, for example, if you were buying, let's say you were buying somewhere and you needed a £200,000 mortgage, but your earned income was only £25,000, the lender knows it's highly unlikely that you're going to get a residential mortgage. So they want to make sure that you're buying this property to let it out and that you're not buying it as a residential to live in because you couldn't afford the mortgage on there. And so they just want to make sure that it all makes sense, really. So if you've already owned somewhere, or you can evidence in the past that you've been a landlord and that's kind of how you generate some of your income. As I say, there are lenders that will do first-time buyers, first-time landlords. You just narrow down your field to the number of lenders that are available, but it is a possibility.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And it's a bit of a sense of dread for sort of particularly my demographic at the minute. Deposits needed for houses, they cancelled the 5%, I believe, with the Help to Buy loans. So that's a bit sad. But so, I mean, if you could expect the average, I guess, 10% deposit for a residential, how does that compare to buy-to-let, or is that completely wrong?
No, yeah, so they do 5% deposit still, and they brought in a guarantee scheme, essentially, probably some point last year, I think, from memory. And so 5% deposits are possible, and there are limitations to that. The amount of borrowing is capped by the government to some degree, and so there are some limitations, but 5% deposit on a residential mortgage is achievable. On a buy-to-let, there's additional risk from the lenders, so they have additional concerns around repossessions in the future. It's much more likely that a buy-to-let property is repossessed rather than someone's home. So to help factor against that, they do want an increased deposit on a buy-to-let. So the normal deposit required is 25%. And so if you're buying somewhere for, say, £200,000, you'd need £50,000 as a deposit. And there are a few lenders that do 20%, so it doesn't have to be 25%, but there are a few that do 20%, but ideally would have a 25% deposit on the buy-to-let. And then there's also stamp duty to factor in as well. And so if you already own somewhere, so if you already own a buy-to-let property, or you're an owner-occupier, you're buying a second property, and there's the additional 3% stamp duty to consider in your purchase costs.
And that's just for England, because there's a different rate for Northern Ireland, is that right?
There is, yes. Yeah, different rate in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, I'm glad that 5% deposits are still on the table. I was rather worried, but that's fantastic. And so I guess we kind of briefly mentioned about stamp duty land tax. Are there any other kind of salient tax implications that we need to be aware of if you're a buy-to-let mortgage recipient?
And so, yeah, I mentioned earlier, all your rental income will need to be declared on your personal tax returns, unless you purchase through a limited company, and then obviously it'll go through the company accounts. But assuming that it's in your personal name, you'll need to declare your rental income to the HMRC once a year. And so you'll need to make sure that you're doing personal tax returns. As a responsible landlord, you'll also need to ensure the property is safe. And so making sure all gas and electrical equipment is safe. A gas certificate is required yearly. Electrical certificate is required at least every 5 years. And then also the deposit from the tenant needs to go into a government approved scheme as well. And so you'll need to make sure that the tenant's deposit is in a safe place should they ever need it back. And so those are kind of the key kind of, I guess, costs to consider as a buy-to-let landlord.
This isn't too complicated either. Sorry about the last one. But what are the kind of timeframes for lending here? Because I know residential, you know, you're kind of in it for the long haul. They're kind of hesitant to lend if you're a bit older. Is that right? And they're more like, that's because you're less likely to pay it off. Is that kind of a similar time frame with buy-to-lets?
Not so much, no. So because the buy-to-let is going to be mainly serviced through the rental income, and not always, people might pay towards it from their own earned income as well. But typically the lender's looking at it based on rental income. So they'll go a lot older in terms of maximum age. Everyone will go to age 80, and there's lenders that will go beyond that. There's lenders that will go past 100. And the Mortgage Works, who are part of Nationwide, one of the biggest lenders in the UK, they don't actually have a maximum age potentially. And they'll do a mortgage up to 35 years, and you can apply at any age. So there's no concern that it needs to be paid off by retirement. They're happy for this to be taken into retirement. And obviously having buy-to-let properties in retirement, if they're providing you a good income, can be a good way to boost your pension.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess on that similar vein, they're still part of the estate as well. Do they get passed down for HD purposes, and then does it become a residential at that point? I mean, this might be too technical as my own curiosity, but
I don't believe it will be, because I presume you can only have one primary residence as per kind of standard tax rule on other bits and pieces. So I presume it will show as an investment property on inheritance tax, but then, they'll be passed down and through the estate.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks for entertaining my whims. Cool. So we covered all of that. And then you mentioned briefly in the previous question about limited companies. Now, some people will want to do it through a limited company. Some people will do it through their own name. What are the differences, and why would one want to do one through the other versus a limited company?
Yeah. So I guess the main draw for most people for limited company is it's potentially more tax efficient. Again, we'd always advise you to speak to your own accountant and get your own independent advice. And we can't provide advice on tax purposes. But the typical view is that it's more tax efficient to own a property through a limited company, particularly if you're a higher rate taxpayer. A general rule of thumb is that if you're purchasing one buy-to-let, maybe isn't worth it. So it's a one-off investment. Maybe you think I'll just hold it in my personal name. There's a cost to running a limited company. You'll need an accountant to complete your annual company accounts to be filed with HMRC. So for one property, it maybe doesn't make sense. But anyone that's looking to invest in a number of properties, a limited company purchase is certainly something to consider and have a discussion with your tax advisor around. The costs are potentially different. So the cost of a limited company buy-to-let mortgage is typically a little bit more expensive than in your personal name. And so it's worth having a chat with a mortgage broker, a good whole of market mortgage broker like ourselves, for example, to understand the costs of personal name versus limited company name. And then you can obviously have a chat with an accountant as well to talk through those costs and see which is the right option for yourself. Now, one thing that can potentially be very good for people that already have limited companies, such as I know some doctors like to do their locum work through limited companies, dentists typically are self-employed and have limited companies, is that you might build up a fund within the limited company. Now, if you wanted to invest in a property in your personal name, you'd need to draw down those funds as dividends, pay tax on it, to then reinvest in a personal name buy-to-let. Potentially, you could set up a new company and transfer the funds between them. So do an intercompany loan between your main trading company and the new vehicle to purchase the property. You could do an intercompany loan and it saves the need to draw out the money as dividend. And potentially, there's a good tax saving in there for any limited company directors.
Yeah, as well as kind of drawing down and dividends and such. Is there any, can you use something called like a director's loan? Is that right? So is that any more?
Potentially, you can take a director's loan from your company. And so, for example, Benison Brown, I could take a director's loan from the company, but that needs to be repaid within 9 months of your tax year ending. So as a short-term loan, you can do. Otherwise, there's potentially tax implications on there. Again, I think I can go through the detail in a bit more detail for you, but essentially, it needs to be repaid within 9 months of your company year ending, and otherwise, there's tax to pay. And so that can obviously be a big cost to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. So we've covered all the limited company stuff. And if you've already got one set up, I believe you covered that as well. If you've already got one.
Yeah, so if you've got a limited company set up, you could potentially use that to purchase the property. But lenders like a clean limited company. And the worry is that if they lend to something that's already trading, maybe there's some issues in the background they're not aware of that puts the property at risk. And from the lender's security perspective, so they like a new limited company that's set up purely for owning property. It can already own property and it just they don't want it to be trading. There are, again, a few lenders that will look at trading companies, but again, you limit your number of lenders available and the potential costs. So ideally, if you're purchasing a property that is a limited company purely for purchasing property, it's called an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, how the lenders describe it, purely for owning property. But you could do, as I said, a kind of a loan between your own company and the new company if you're wanting to fund a deposit.
I think we might cover a little case study a bit later on, but just as a generic example, say there's like Bill Bloggs Partners at Law and then Bill Bloggs Property Partners at Law or whatever. Yeah. As a separate thing, clean slate, the specific one would be more likely to be accepted for a buy-to-let because it's got less baggage. Is that the right way of phrasing it?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, they don't know what's gone on in the other company. Have they got any creditors that are coming after them that, as I say, could put the lender's security at risk, that property? So a clean slate, a brand new company, so, or a company specifically for owning property is what they're really wanting to lend to.
I had no idea. That's really interesting. Brilliant. And I guess, you know, before we get into the case study, just a few more general tips. If there's any doctors listening out there who might be thinking this might be for them, if they've got a limited company or they just fancy giving it a go, what are your kind of top few tips for people looking to get into the buy-to-let market?
I'd say having a clear strategy for what you're looking to purchase and what you're looking to achieve. So knowing, you know, I said earlier about, do you want to find somewhere? Do you want to find the right property that's going to grow in value? Or do you want to find somewhere that's going to give you a return on your income each month? And a very general rule is that the further south you go, the more likely you're going to have a growth in value. And the further north you go, the better rental yield you get, the better return on your investment each month. So thinking about what your strategy is and thinking about where you want to purchase. Do you want to be that hands-on landlord? Because if you do, then you're probably looking more in your local area. Or are you happy to invest in an area of the country and have some good people there, find an agent and find some people to look after the property for you? Knowing what your costs are, so how much deposit you've got available, thinking about the additional cost of stamp duty, and then whether you want to buy that in your personal name or whether you want to go through the limited company option are probably kind of the key costs to understanding or the key kind of things to consider before taking it on and looking at some properties.
Yeah, just more on like hands-on versus agency. I think as a tenant myself, I've had better experiences with hands-on, and I think generally some agencies maybe have a less than savory reputation for students in particular. But do you know what the split is? Do most people decide to go hands-on, or do most people decide to just let an agency take care of it?
I think there's kind of a middle ground that's quite popular. So you're maybe hands-on in terms of managing the property, but the agent will then find and vet tenants for you and obviously charge you a fee. So they can manage that, and then you kind of get involved in, if something goes wrong, arranging for somebody to go out. It's one of the things that I was thinking of on this before this podcast was that there's a lot of good landlords out there. There's a lot of good people, and we speak to a lot of them where, for example, you know, I was saying earlier about the rental income that's needed for the property. And because mortgage rates have been so low for so long, a lot of properties aren't achieving that in terms of the rental income at the moment. But if they went to the market, they would, because the rental income's gone up. And there's a lot of landlords that have almost protected their tenants from rent increasing, protected them from some degree. And then suddenly they're finding, oh, my mortgage rate's going up two or three times, and my payments are going up. And that's then being passed on to tenants, which is what we've kind of seen over the last year. And a lot of landlords don't want to do it. They don't want to have that conversation and explain that, you know, your payments are going from X amount to Y amount. But they're almost kind of being forced to by the current market and the way that things are costing.
Yeah. I guess one last question I had, you'll be delighted to hear. In terms of sort of, I guess, exit fees, I mean, a full suite of kind of remortgaging and, you know, part exchanging and just straight up selling, is that kind of an easy process? Is it similar to residential? Are there any things we need to be aware of?
No, not particularly. So yeah, similar to residential. So as you say, when you come to the end of the deal, we can remortgage, we can pick a new product with the existing lender. That's relatively straightforward. And potentially when you come to sell the property, I guess the one major difference between a buy-to-let and your primary residence is that capital gains tax will be payable. And so consider your exit from that perspective, that you need to factor in any capital gains tax that could be payable on any gains that you've made.
Always looking in the background. Capital gains. Brilliant. Okay, so lastly, have you got any case studies of an individual who, you know, maybe benefited from buy-to-lets, who had financial success?
Yeah, certainly. So we've got a client that we still work with very regularly. They came to us probably quite early days in our company, and they were working as a solicitor and earning a good salary. However, they wanted to change kind of what they were doing with their life and the direction that it was going. They already owned a property, so they owned a residential property, and we helped them purchase their first buy-to-let with savings that they'd made through their earned income. They bought in London, which I mentioned earlier. You tend to find out historically has been good for capital growth. So when we came to review the mortgage in 2 years' time, there was a bit of equity that we could take out of the property. And so when we came to remortgage, we withdrew some equity through additional borrowing, and the additional funds meant they could set up a limited company. So the first purchase had been in their personal name. They then made a decision to set up a limited company to purchase more properties. And they purchased a couple of properties with the equity that we released. I think that was around the Liverpool area that they went to purchase, which gave them good rental income, and so allowed them to start drawing an income from the investment property. And again, we kept reviewing the mortgages every couple of years and drawing out as much as we could to allow them to continue to grow their portfolio. I think they're now up to 11 properties that they own in there, and that's over the course of, say, 5 years. And it's given them the freedom to give up the job, so they're no longer working as a solicitor. They focus now solely on their buy-to-let properties, and they also help other clients go out and purchase new properties as well. So they act as a bit of a property finder. And so that's certainly someone who kind of jumped on the buy-to-let wagon and made a good investment, I guess, it initially allowed them to draw out the money and use that to continue to develop their portfolio from there.
I actually thought of one more little bonus question as well. So... sometimes, I guess historically, sometimes there have been different rates or different kind of quirks for London, right? With the old Help to Buy ISA. Mm-hmm. I know the property value was slightly increased over that of the rest of the country. Yes. Is there anything with London specifically that people need to be aware of, or is it more or less the same as the rest, above in the price, obviously?
Yeah, it's the same rules as the rest of the country for buy-to-lets. And when rates started to go up, so if we go back to October 22, when rates or the market started to struggle a little bit, shall we say, in terms of the cost of mortgages, one of the areas that really was hit was London buy-to-lets. Because if you go back to the rental income calculation that the lenders were doing, they've increased the stress rate, obviously, as the mortgage rates went up. And it's always been a bit of an issue in London, but anything over around 200,000, 250,000, it was really hard to get a mortgage on because of the rental income versus the mortgage amount if you're not putting down a big deposit, if you're maybe at a 25% deposit. So the London buy-to-let property market really struggled. But lenders have tried to change how they do some of their calculations. So there's lenders that will take personal income into account. So if you're earning a good salary and you can afford your own life and you've got a lot of additional cash left over, we could potentially use that toward mortgage calculations, affordability shortfalls. But also one of the things that lenders have done over the last probably 6 months or so is the rate that you pay on your mortgage is low, but there's a high fee to set up. So for example, we've had buy-to-let lenders offering rates at 4%. Bearing in mind the base rate is still 5.25% at this time. So they're offering a 4% mortgage, but then there's a large fee up front to make that work from their perspective. So we've had fees of maybe 7 or 8%. But it does mean that the rental calculation then starts to work because they could maybe use that 4% towards their stress testing rather than the 6% or so that they were using previously. And so from a lender's perspective, I think the one thing that's different from this, say, financial crash that we're maybe in at the moment compared to 2007, 2008, is that lenders have consistently wanted to lend throughout. They've been trying to lend. They've been trying to do things to make things attractive for clients as best as they can with the current costs. And whereas if we go back in 2007, they didn't want to lend. They almost shut up shop a little bit. And so lenders are trying to be creative. But London's a challenge for buy-to-let mortgages. But there are lenders that can support that and can start to make it work.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully we've not missed anything out. I think we've covered pretty much the basics, haven't we?
I think we have done the basics and more. Thanks to you, Matthew.
Yeah, no. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for your time.
No problem. Thank you very much for inviting us back.
Not a problem. How can people best get a hold of you if they've got any follow-up questions or need to speak?
Certainly. So our contact number is 0207 427 6067. And if they search Benison Brown, you'll find us on Google with all our contact information on there. And obviously you can find ourselves through Medics Money as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much, Michael. I'm looking forward to speaking soon.
Perfect. Thank you, Matthew.